As he stood on the dock of the brown-shingled boathouse, Averill Harriman paid little notice to the spindly boy rowing in seat 7 of the Shell hacking up the languid Nashua River. Dean Acheson was more than a year younger and 2 forms behind him, and at Groton there was little fraternizing between boys of different ages. In addition, with his air of stoic detachment, Harriman seemed aloof even to students his own age. He had been taught to row by a private tutor on his family's own private lake, and the other boys came to regard him as more of a coach than a schoolmate as he helped organize the underclass crews. Acheson, on the other hand, had quickly earned a reputation for being too cheeky for his own good. He went out for rowing only because the school required that each boy play some sport. Yet Harriman soon came to believe, as he later recalled, that the boy with toothpick legs and an impish demeanor showed some promise, at least on the water. He began to offer unsolicited tips, a bit of encouragement. Eventually, he would bestow the pronouncement that Acheson was a good oar. In the years to come, Harriman would continue to fancy himself a tutor to the fresh schoolmate he had helped with the intricacies of stroking an oar. He would lecture Acheson about the post-war Soviet threat, and, much later, gently prod him about the futility of the Vietnam War. Acheson, for his part, would later confess to being bemused by Harriman's plodding and sovereign style, though he would find him ever a reliable ally when it counted. And when it was all over, just weeks before he died in 1971, Acheson would recall the relationship fondly in a letter to his old friend. "Sometimes it amuses me to confuse the young by pointing out what really elder statesmen we are, by telling them that our friendship began, though perhaps neither of us knew it at the time, 66 years ago this month. Then I came as a new boy to the school at which you were a little, though not much, my senior. In most of those years that have passed, we have joined in activities that sometimes have been pretty strenuous, first of all on the water, where we rowed, and later in government, where we struggled." Harriman's sense of sovereignty and detachment was hardly surprising. He was the eldest son of one of America's richest men, a domineering railway tycoon whose family more closely resembled a medieval duchy than an American household. Edward Henry Harriman's personal fortune surpassed $70 million at a time when there was no inheritance tax, the average hourly wage was 22 cents, and a dollar could buy an imported linen dress shirt or 100 eggs. His money was entirely self-made. "My capital when I began was a pencil and this," he would say, tapping his head. The first American Harriman was a London stationer who had migrated to New Haven in 1795 and made a comfortable fortune chartering vessels for trade in the West Indies. But E.H. Harriman's father had been an itinerant Episcopal clergyman who wandered through California preaching in prospecting camps before returning east as the rector of a small wooden church in Jersey City. At age 14, E.H. dropped out of school to become a $5-a-week messenger boy at a brokerage house on Wall Street. "I have become convinced that there is something else in life for me besides school and books," he told his disapproving father. "I am going to work." A compact dynamo, he plunged with relish into the cutthroat market of the robber baron era. With $3,000 borrowed from a wealthy uncle, he bought himself a seat on the stock exchange and captured Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt and Jay Gould as his mentors and clients. By 26, E.H. had parlayed his own first fortune of $150,000 by selling short in coal mine stocks when he guessed that a speculator's attempt to corner the market would fail.